Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. In today's podcast, originally recorded in 2000, Dr. Charles Plott, William D. Hacker, Professor of Economics and Political Science at the California Institute of Technology, and the late Dr. Kenneth Arrow, Professor of Economics at Stanford University and 1972 Nobel Prize winner in Economic Sciences, discuss theory and experiments with markets. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, Ken, I'm certainly glad to be chatting with you today.
Great, Charles.
We don't have a chance to chat enough. Let's start by exploring the aspects of equilibrium and concepts of equilibrium, why markets exist, and why do we suppose or assume or observe something called equilibrium, or why supply should equal demand. What do you see as the both the theoretical and perhaps even empirical foundations for these fundamental principles of economics?
Yeah, economics, I think, is based on the idea that people are different or have different roles in economic life. They specialize. Why they specialize is a long story, but that people are different, and therefore there is room for trade. People who are, workers will, in effect, sell their labor to produce, to help in the production of goods, which they then subsequently, so their labor is bought by firms, which in turn sell goods to them. So they specialize in, some people are producing steel, some people are producing software, some people have to get a little modern, and these people are essentially trading among themselves. So we take any particular commodity, any particular good, we have kind of market for it. Some people want to sell them, some people want to buy them. In the bulk of economic transactions, it's not universal, transactions take place in what's called a price system. Essentially, there's some kind of a price at which people buy and sell. People buy, and of course, we expect that as the price rises, people will buy less. And the other hand, as the price rises, people are willing to sell more, making more profits. That has been spelled out at great length, but that's the nub of the idea. Now, the idea, a very natural idea in this analysis, now this is probably a product of the modern world, and transactions certainly have taken place in different societies in different ways, but this is a very important aspect, probably in some ways from ancient times, a part of the economy, and today a very dominant part. Supposing the price is such that people want to sell more than the people who want to sell are offering more than people want to buy. Well, we presume, and this is the theoretical aspect, which has to be confirmed against empirical data of all sorts, including experimental data, that more people want to sell than buy at a given moment. One of the sellers will find it worthwhile to cut his price, his or her price, in order to get rid of this stuff that he can't unload. The opposite, if demanders, if there's an excess demand, if people want more than is available. So the general idea of equilibrium is, in a single market at least, is that so long as supply and demand are not equal, as long as the willingness to buy and the willingness to sell are not equal, there'll be a move to change the price. Therefore, the only place it'll rest is at a point where supply equals demand. In our theory, we call that equilibrium, a term which means equal weight and is derived from the idea of ideas in mechanics of, let's say, a rod balancing, it's being balanced on a fulcrum. It's a term which has been taken over. And the idea is it's a resting point, a point where the force is going one way, balance the forces going the other. Now, that these simple words can be made spun out in a great many theories, and for important purposes, it is. The technicalities are extremely important. But as you see, there's an underlying, rather simple theoretical concept. And the question, of course, like all theoretical concepts, is it true? The ideas are derived from introspection, rather casual observation of the way of transactions. They do exemplify more or less things like stock exchanges, and that's indeed where one of this, the great pioneer Léon Walras took his example from the Paris Bourse. But I think this kind of casual evidence is not enough, and we have to resort to other kinds of evidence to see if it really works. You've conducted a great many tests of this hypothesis and in many variations while using experiments, which is a novel concept in economics, which has not been a traditional source of knowledge. Perhaps you'd like to tell us how you've, first place, your methodology, and second place, what why you came to this way of approaching things, and second, what results you see in whether supply and demand are really equal.
Well, it's interesting. As I was listening to your answer, I was reflecting on the several really deep concepts that and controversial concepts that are implicit in this, like. When you started, you mentioned about people differ. Well, that seems, but implicit in that is the idea that people are also purposeful. They want different things. They seek different things. And so, of course, the purposefulness of people is a deep axiom or deep principle of economics. And then from that difference becomes the law of comparative advantage, the gains from exchange, and the idea of specialization. And so one can see from this very simple idea, or two ideas, that people difference and they're purposeful, that one can, from that, deduce a concept of trade. And then this concept of purposefulness then translates into almost like a law of one price. If I can get it cheaper, or if I'm going to be excluded from the market, I'm going to offer a better deal. And so the prices gravitate down until the purposes balance out. And we get to an equilibrium. And while that seems so commonsensical and so consonant with our intuition and our personal experience, at least the personal experiences of some people, I'd like to know whether I can observe it, that somehow I learn to be skeptical of my own intuition, or even the intuition of other people, because what we observe in our personal environment isn't necessarily what's going on. It's like we're kind of like a fish. And a fish who sits in a stream behind a rock watches a fly come down. The fish goes up, gets the fly in an energy minimizing way, and comes back to rest. Now, that fish knows how to catch the fly, like a businessman knows how to catch a consumer, better than any other creature in the world. But the fish can't understand hydrodynamics. It doesn't understand stream flow. It doesn't understand what happens if there's an increase in the flood or a dam. To understand our environment, because it interacts with us so much, we need to get outside the stream and look. In essence, that's the motivation for an experiment. It's an attempt to look at a system as something other than just a participant and ask, do these laws that we see actually evolve into according to the way the theory? These days I'm skeptical of using the word theory. I tend to use the word model because the theories are typically so precise they're wrong, but yet they capture the essence of a great deal of a phenomena. The idea of creating an experiment then is to create something very simple that we could observe. Some people say it's not the real world, but that's, I think, a misconception. It is the real world. It's simple. It's not as complex as the naturally occurring phenomena. So people tend to confuse simplicity with reality. It's reality, but it's also simple. The question is, can we understand with some precision these simple things that one can create in an experiment? And then the second question is, once we understand the simple things, does that help us in understanding these more complex phenomena that economics is all about? I think with respect to the law of supply and demand, any of us who observe this or study an experiment, we're struck with the power of these models. This idea of convergence is very robust. We've watched this thousands of times. You could take the simple little mathematical model that, of course, you're so familiar with, and ask, is it the case that the price has settled down close to this equilibrium predicted by the model? And we find, yes, it is. And if we change the demand and supply, we'll find the price is evolving as that quantitative model predicts. And frequently, I really do call it the law of supply and demand. It's so robust. But it's much different from our models. Our models, the price is a constant. We don't see constant prices in an experiment. There's always movement. There's always some force of randomness. Prices don't start at one price, but the variance will shrink. And so we can actually see many principles at work in an experiment that that the theory doesn't anticipate. And another thing we find quite interesting, I know you've thought about quite a bit, are the different instruments that might occur in a market, the different rules which might govern the laws of markets. And there, unfortunately, we frequently see phenomena, but we can't model it. In particular, in game theory, when there's small numbers. And I think that those of us who are studying markets now look more and more to game theory and to strategic structure to understand this phenomena at the level that you're discussing it, at least from the point of view of strategic maneuvers that an individual goes and from which this phenomena of prices emerge. Another thing, though, that we find quite fascinating that I think is unique to economics or in the social sciences is a concept of efficiency. When we postulate there are gains from exchange, there's a magnitude of gain from exchange. We can see whether it's exhausted or not. And there we discover, yes, markets can exhaust this gain from exchange. And so the resting place is, as you postulate, where there's no more gains from change, and because the gains from exchange have been exhausted. So,
well, that's very exciting. I've heard these experiments, and people now use them even in classrooms to teach elementary economics, and they're always somewhat astounded at this. Even the professors, while they expected to come into equilibrium, they're really surprised at the speed with which this happens, and that at least in simple situations where you're not calculating. Now, one of the complications that essential complication in this case that theorists have brought to mind is the interdependence of markets. That while we talk about, let's say, a market for some good bread or something, the fact is that markets are linked to each other. And necessarily, not really, it's not really a fact that they are, but it's really of the essence that they are. Namely, that is, roughly speaking, if the price of one good goes up, well, either I shift away from that good and therefore go to some other good, which gives me the same services, may shift from bread to cereal or something, if bread gets expensive and cereal doesn't, or on the contrary, I may keep on buying the bread, in which case I'll have less money left over to buy other goods. So that the idea is the amount that people want of any good depends not only on the price of that good, but depends on the prices of other goods. So markets are linked, and this has given rise to the idea that you want demand and supply to be equal, by the same argument that we gave before, on all markets at the same time. So what you have to have is prices, one for each commodity, which simultaneously cause all supplies to equal all demands. Supplies and demands to be equal on all markets. And this is a much richer, more complicated thing. The idea that supply and demand are equal on a market was something that economists in the 18th century, like Adam Smith and even earlier, took almost for granted, in fact. It's hard to say they even argued for it. But the idea that markets are interdependent in this more general way that I described is really something that only gradually emerged in the course of the 19th century was formulated first by the French economist Walras that I mentioned earlier. This has given rise to a lot of elaboration as to just what the model consisted of, and I won't bore you with all the details, and even question whether you can show that there exists solutions to these, which will possibly was a matter of controversy even as late as the 30s and 40s, really wasn't settled until the early 50s, 1950s. Now, this makes creates new opportunities, shall I say, for experimental study, or at least a much more complicated theory to test. Can you say something about how experimental evidence has been brought to bear on this question of multiple markets?
Well, I think that the study of multiple markets is just now coming into existence. It's made possible by new experimental technology dealing with the web. If you're going to study multiple markets, you have to have a technology for getting prices, multiple prices in multiple markets to multiple people. We know that if markets are too thin, surprisingly, they don't have to be very thin. They don't have to be very thick for price discovery to take place in a systematic way. But if people are dealing with lots of markets, it's useful to have many people. So running an experiment with 20 people in a room is doable. 50 people becomes a little hard. 100 people becomes really impossible without new technologies, which are coming online now. And so we're just now beginning to explore how interdependent markets work, and creating experiments large enough to explore this possibility. And of course, the question of linkage that you raise, to me, is a key question for economics, because the specialization and law of comparative advantage and gains from specialization, of course, should be coordinated by these interdependent markets. So the question is, can they interact in a way that's disruptive or causing problems or lacking of coordination? So how that happens is, of course, the great mystery. One of the things we've discovered, even in a single market, is that the adjustment path tends to be Marshallian in a way. The system will go first in the areas where the gains of exchange are greatest. So when you look at markets...
Marshallian, referring to the...
Marshallian, remember, Marshall postulated a very specific...
Alfred Marshall was a famous economist.
Yes, of course. Marshall postulated that the person who valued the first people to trade in a market would be the person who valued it the most, would be trade with the person who had the least cost. And so he thought that you would march down the demand curve and up the supply curve, and these people pairing off by some natural way. The remarkable thing is that postulate is not terribly wrong, in the sense that you do observe that to some extent in single markets. In multiple markets, however, you observe it in a much more interesting way, because markets which are, quote, most important, where the gains from exchange in some sense are greatest, the system will move there to equate those markets first. And then after those markets are equated, and it's interesting, it seems as though the system moves to gain the gains from exchange. After the exchange starts, then prices adjust to support it as an equilibrium. And as that support begins to develop, the other market begins to equilibrate. So we see a process that this equilibration seems to take place through. The remarkable thing is that in multiple markets, and we haven't studied enormous systems, but we have studied systems up to 18 and 20 markets that are quite complex. The amazing thing is that this phenomena does occur. And as people adjust in one area, it will move to another area. Now, the interesting question, of course, is it possible for the parameters or the environment of the market to be such that this process of adjustment in some sense could be disruptive or fail to equilibrate? Well, as it turns out, we can identify such places. At least we think we can identify such phenomena and understand somewhat or something about the circumstances in which continuous price movement might occur without ever any equilibration because of the way these markets are interlinked. Now, the interesting thing is going to be whether people's beliefs or learning or expectations or speculation will ultimately smooth that out, so this type of cyclic behavior will not occur forever, or whether special instruments will develop in markets, like futures markets or state contingent markets or other types of, or changing the sequence in which prices are developed, will evolve naturally to circumvent this. And which, of course, that brings us into another interesting, very interesting area about special instruments and information and other aspects that economics has been so productive, and you've been so productive in exploring. And to me, that's one of the most interesting areas to study, and it's really not separate from two additional questions, namely the institutions or the framework in which economic activity takes place, as well as how information is held in markets. And it's also connected to the dynamics, the time dependency and time structure of economic activities, which, of course, fundamental. And I know you've studied a great deal. So,
well, let's turn to the question of information that you we haven't mentioned that, and yet behind the economic system, behind even the even as we described, there's a good deal of knowledge or information. There's individuals you are supposed to know their preferences, their purposes, as you to use the expression used before. They know something about themselves. Well, that's not quite as clear cut as it might be. For example, I may want health, but I have no great knowledge of how to achieve it. I'm not feeling well. Well, I go to an expert.
Yes.
Because there is, for various reasons, knowledge is specialized, like everything else. Just as we spoke before about people having different abilities, people having different purposes, and this is a grounds for trade. But one of the points is that knowledge is also separated and specialized. And there are places that occurs for all sorts of natural reasons. Also, there are good economic reasons why knowledge should be specialized. If you're going to use it over and over again, it pays somebody to know, have that knowledge and apply it. It doesn't pay everybody to have medical knowledge. It would be uneconomic, since you can use the knowledge over and over again. So we expect, and also require a lot of knowledge simply a byproduct of our daily activities. If I'm a producer, I'm likely to learn gradually how to do things better. If I'm a consumer, I know what, if nothing else, I know what I like, and what appeals to me, which may be different from what appeals to you. And if I live one part of the country, I get to know that part of the country better, how I can live best in it. So we expect to have a lot of dispersed knowledge. I'll show you a familiar example, which has been made much of in the literature, is, let's say, producing agricultural products. Orange juice is a famous example where people have tried to say, if you want to predict the weather, you should look at what the price of orange juice, frozen, concentrate for frozen orange juice. Because the idea is that each farmer knows something about his own weather. And there's developed a view that which is implicit in the older literature, but really only that's kind of been made kind of sharp in the beginning of the 1950s, and maybe not even the 1960s. The idea that there's a lot of dispersed information in the economy. A lot of people, each one knows a little bit. And each one knows something which is very small on the scale of the whole economy. But together, if you could somehow pool all this, you would have a great deal of knowledge. For example, the weather conditions underlying crops was the favorite example, but that's only one. This, of course, is a kind of argument, rather loosely put. It was used as an argument in the controversies over whether socialism was a an efficient method of economic organization. The discussion occurred very much in the 1930s to 1950s. But then it became formal, but it took a while before I think it got into what we call really formal models as opposed to rather vague slogans. Now a theory began to develop under one of the interesting examples of a theory that had no single progenitor, a great many people, each of whom added on a little bit, Roy Radner or Joseph Stiglitz or Sanford Grossman. So the idea was that somehow the prices in the market could reflect all the information in the market, or at least a great deal of it, even though any one individual knew very little. I gather that you've been subjecting some of your experimentees to tests of this hypothesis, and I'd really like to see how it works out in the laboratory.
Well, you know, as I listen to you explain this, I'm struck with in some sense, the power of economic theory, at least the specialness of it, the idea that information or knowledge could be a subject of specialization like any commodity. It could be produced like any other commodity, and that it could be exchanged, and the same laws would govern, and same principles would govern this exchange of information and knowledge as would any commodity at all. I just find that so striking, and that one might attempt to measure knowledge, a little knowledge or aggregated knowledge, and use the idea of Bayes' law and other types of features to characterize this very complex phenomena is really pretty amazing. And of course, that attracted the experimentalists immediately. And one of the first things that we noticed was a controversy dealing with things like futures markets. People would look at futures markets or options and think that people who participated in these markets were doing nothing but gambling. It's just organized, legalized gambling. As a matter of fact, from time to time, Congress would examine things like futures markets, thinking that they're disruptive and these are just ugly speculators. The idea that speculation might have a purpose in organizing information, which was an economic commodity but a different commodity, somehow was quite foreign, except in the economic literature. One of the first things we discovered was that if you have markets that are dependent, the values of which dependent upon now, and some values depend upon things of the future. Ordinarily, if there's a market, a spot market, the price develops, and when the events occur in the future, the market reacts. It's very disruptive. By adding a futures market, the information and intuition about what's going to happen in the future is brought to the present. It's actually produced now. And decisions now could anticipate what's going to happen later, and the markets become much more efficient. The whole system becomes much more efficient because information is better. Now, the surprising thing is that the spot price will increase its variance because there's more information it's reflecting. People thought that the futures market was disrupting the spot market because of the increased variance. Now we know that it's a very natural phenomena, that the spot market is actually tracking things actually much better. Which was, of course, astounding. First, that these ideas coming from your work would find manifestation in such an obvious and profound way. Then the next thing we asked was the second issue that you raised. Can markets aggregate information? Suppose, for example, there are three states of nature. You can eliminate one, say X. I can eliminate another one, Y. Together we know it's Z. But we're not together. We can't speak. the interactions in the market, in some sense, combine us, our information. So I know that it's Z, and you know it's Z, even though I had partial information. The answer to that question is, if we're very similar, you and I, it can work. But if we're quite different in terms of our attitudes towards risk or other things, it won't work. This aggregation process somehow breaks down, and a single market won't reflect our, won't be successful in bringing us together, as this theory suggests.
Do you want to elaborate as to what, a little bit as to why this failure takes place?
I'll tell you, if you see what happens when we change the market a little, I think it becomes obvious. First, as I said, if we're very similar, this will take place. But if we're different, the market has trouble. But then if I change the market and add what look like options that depend on the state, so there's a state that pays off as X, a state that pays off Y. If I, rather than dealing with a single market, I change the instruments and so they're ancillary markets, then for information aggregates beautifully. So the paradox is, why is it the case that some work and some don't work where the same principles would seem to apply? Our speculation is that while each individual is rational, they really don't trust the rationality of other people. So when I watch the market adjust, unless you're very much like me, I can't understand and I don't know how to interpret what it is you're doing. And so, and you're in the same way. So because we don't have deep knowledges about each, because other people in the market, there are other variables that become confounded with the information extraction, and the market itself doesn't work so well. By adding these other instruments, it allows me to triangulate better on who you are and to capitalize your mm-hmm. rationality. For example, let's suppose that one market pays off if the state is X and zero otherwise. You have the knowledge, not X. So what do? You sell that security. Well, when I see you selling that security, there's almost an unambiguous way for me to track what it is you must believe, because for that particular instrument, it captures a lot of different kinds of preferences. And so these instruments, while the theory itself suggests that there's a dimensionality problem, there probably is a dimensionality problem, but yeah. There's a deeper issue that's yeah. implicit in our theory about what you know about other people and the rationality you attribute to them. And I think that these additional instruments help. The upshot is that this information aggregation process that you see, or our theorists suggest is there, we see in unambiguous terms in experiments. It's quite amazing.
The view has been, people who worked on the real life data tend to the argument too, that the markets tend to, but you mentioned this dimensionality problem, which may not clear to everybody. The argument is there are a number of things that are unknown to each other. And one of them is, let's say, that you know something about the world which I don't know. But also it's true that you have a different attitude of risk bearing. And if I don't have very many prices, I really can't tell those two apart. So even if I really believe you're rational, I can't quite make out just from futures prices alone. You want something which reflects the betting as to a bet which really depends on what the state of the world security. Let me not say a bet because that sounds like gambling, yes. But a security whose payoff depends on what the state of the world is will add to it. That's why options on future. I remember many years ago I wrote a memorandum for the
Commodity Futures Exchange Commission. Yeah,
that's right. On the why they should permit. Option trade. It was prohibited originally, option trading on commodity futures, because it enriched the knowledge base from which people can make inferences. I think in the real world, of course, there are a lot of there's still a lot of complications. For example, as far as I can see, the evidence is that farmers don't use futures markets very much.
Is that interesting?
This is a surprise, except the buyers of commodities, the millers, for example, one who expect to buy wheat, are very heavily in the market. But the rest of it is made up of outside speculators and who are contributing knowledge and certainly contributing capital, and of course, traders who have seats on the market. So it doesn't seem to achieve perfection just yet, but it's obviously improves, and it certainly serves as a forecasting device of very high quality, which is what your experiments also show, that you can infer from the from the outcome. People can reveal the states just from knowing the outcome. Yeah.
We see several examples of this. Once you understand the principles involved. By the way, I must say that the introduction to the options and the role of theory in the introduction to options in the United States is a singularly amazing contribution of economics to the economy itself. Mm-hmm. It's such a valuable set of institutions that common sense would have never allowed without the power of the theory. And so it's very exciting to see this growth that really evolves from basic research only.
That's right.
Not common sense, not business experience, from pure theory. It's amazing. But we see this a lot, and people don't recognize it, like the odds from Las Vegas. Really quite accurate. The betting in horse races. It's not perfect, but if you bet on the long shot, you're not going to win. It's organized in the Iowa political stock market, in which you can actually buy securities in politicians. And the amazing thing is the prices in those, which of course are built on exactly these principles, do better than the polling techniques. Now, of course, I think that is going to bring us to a really interesting phase of economics, where the ideas of multiple markets and ideas of multiple market institutions are involved to create new forms of markets that have as their only purpose this information aggregation procedures. Mm-hmm. So like economists at one time were inventing new forms of markets and in antitrust and control of markets and understanding the principles that would channel competition and self-interest in ways that benefit the consumers, which of course is the history of economics. I think that we're beginning to approach an age where modern technologies, the use of information economics, our understanding of the role of various instruments in information aggregation will be used to create tools to do jobs like information aggregation that no one ever dreamed could be possible. I'm really excited about this as a possibility.
I think, but actually some of these exist today, I believe. For example, there are markets where the S&P, you essentially transact depending on the outcome of the S&P 500. It's not based on stocks.
That's
true.
There's
no stocks 100. It's a pure informational equilibrium. And of course, it is used as a hedging device by traders. So it actually already serves a social function, not as big as one might expect. Another version is the catastrophe futures. I forget what they're called, but I think the Chicago Board of Trade has these, where you can essentially bet on earthquakes or hurricanes. It's an alternative to an insurance system, and has one way. It's better because that's kind of a free access insurance. By its nature, tends to be large. I mean, in order to have stability, it has to have large corporations. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there are relatively few of them. And therefore, in a sense, their information processing tends to be limited. Catastrophe futures, I don't think I have the right term, but it's something like that, already provide ways in which the information on the possibilities of, say, hurricane damage and so forth. And so if you buy one, you'd get paid off if there's a hurricane, not on the basis of the damage to your house, but on the basis simply of the fact that there's a hurricane, a verifiable thing, as something which could be bought by, for example, bought by insurance companies as part of their way of trading. Now, this is not, that one has not made a big impact. The S&P 500 is a bigger market. The catastrophe of just beginning. So the idea is there already, and I think you're quite right with modern communications technologies. The ease of creating these things will be greater, and you can get a better pooling in really on a worldwide basis now, not even confined to the capital market of the United States, which in the case of catastrophes is important because they can occur anywhere. Let me raise another thing which you've done, I know you've done a great deal of work on. Let me relate it again to the history of economic theory. There is always, as we've already indicated in several ways, there's always a future. There's a present and a future. And a great deal of the present is involved in one way or another by what the future will bring. The most obvious sort of thing are savings, where you want an income for some future time, for example, retirement or for an estate or whatever, or just protection against the contingencies of life, like losing a job. So you have a savings phenomenon. And of course, the counterpart of that is investment by firms for the future. You buy, extreme case, land, which lasts forever, but where you put up a building expected to last for 30 years or 20 years, or electric power plant, or even shorter term, and a machine. Now, these are based on the idea that I'm going to expend resources today, and they're real resources. They're resources from the point of view of the country as well as from the point of view of the individual. And with the idea that I will be earning an income in the future. The simplest form, of course, is securities that you can buy and sell on the market. These generally are issued because behind that is the intention, is that they're sold in order to make the real investments. Mm-hmm. So there's a condition which we've spoken before about linkages among markets. Well, there's a linkage between present market and future. We've already referred to futures markets. And this is general. We're saying it's just part of a broader phenomenon of intertemporal things. And the simplest case to think about is, and a very prominent one, is that of securities, where people are buying and selling them with a view toward future returns. And returns are, what are the returns on security? Let's say an equity, a stock, a common stock. Well, we think of it as dividends. Or there are two kinds of returns. One is the dividend. One is the fact that the price may go up. There are capital gains and dividends. And historically, dividends have been a significant part of the income. Actually, today, they're rather small, although there's a bit of an illusion in that because we have a lot of repurchase of stocks by companies. It's a rather large amount, which is really a kind of dividend. So that it's, if you look at the present claim that dividends are negligible, it's not quite right when you think of the other forms in which purchases can take, which the corporation can pay out to the stockholders. But anyway, it's certainly true that capital gains are also a part of the story. Now, the question is, what is this hanging by? Because the price, the present, depends on these, what I'm willing to buy today, and what I'm willing to buy the stock for today, depends on my expectations about the prices and the dividends. But the prices in the future, which I'm anticipating today, are themselves based upon the still further future. And you get a kind of a paradoxical element. Now, one can set up a theoretical model. And this was work that was started by, in the 1930s, Erik Lindahl, the Swedish economist, John Hicks, and it was continued by others later. The idea of thinking, well, maybe you should think of the present, of the future markets as already existing today. This is a story. It's not a reality. The counterpart to make it more operational, and therefore the idea of equilibrating with multiple markets, can be the theory can be then applied. Well, that's a bit of a fiction, but the what we think of as the real-life counterpart is what's come to be known as rational expectations, that people correctly anticipate what the future market will bring. And as I say, securities would be a simple case because you think of the current prices depending on the future prices. Now, when I say will bring, it may be not with certainty, but with uncertainty. But the idea is the same. Now, you've been studying asset markets, and I think it would be very interesting to summarize how the experimentation goes with regard to the equilibration of asset markets.
Well, there's actually some very deep issues involved in this. One is, do I anticipate the future? Do I analytically try to compute what's in the future, or are my future expectations simply a smoothing from what I've seen in the past? Now, there's no doubt that there's some extrapolation from the past, but when you see the speed with which markets adjust and how these price formation takes place, there's also no doubt that people actually compute and postulate what's going to happen in a cognitive way. They're not just extrapolating from the past. So this inertia that one sees, some of it's there, but that's not what really drives the structure of the dynamics over time. And there, as it turns out, I think that you probably state that there's a relationship between both information and the linkages between markets. There's also another one you didn't state, and that's what's, especially as you move into capital markets, what's the motivation of the people who are spending your money for you? Like, for example, funds managers, are they really trying to manage your funds, or are they just trying to give you an annual return that's as good as other fund managers? So are they trying to mirror the investments of other fund managers? So are they rewarded if they go against the stream? And so I think that there's someone should be concerned about, in essence, what we would call a principal agent problems of the people who are investing for you, which is a different matter than the way markets themselves might anticipate. There we see that things like futures markets are very effective in maintaining rational expectations over time. People do anticipate what other people are going to do, usually correctly. That's the good news. The bad news is that they can make mistakes. And so sometimes all of a sudden the market will find itself in a mistake, and when it corrects with absolute amazing speed. There's no such thing as getting out on a down market. It's as soon as it's there, everyone realizes it, and the market goes down. So I think that we still have some paradoxes in assets and valuation over time. But, you know, you didn't mention one of the most interesting assets that's backed by nothing is money, which is backed by nothing except the belief that someone else is going to take it. Of course, there's laws that help, but it is this continually understanding about what other people are likely to do drives the value of money, and it also drives the value of our assets and keeps it tied to something that's real, at least we hope is real. But I think that the choices over time and the linkages over time and instruments which help us understand things over time are really quite really an exciting place to do research.
Let me press you a little bit, because it seems to you that there's more to some of the results that you've shown haven't been fully brought out here.
Yeah.
Keynes, for example, talks about the fact that there's a herd effect in investments. People think things are good, they listen to each other, and this can build up into a boom. And of course, history, which has no substance, as you just said, you get a down market and it adjusts all right. But this may take place over quite a long period of time. And of course, we have historically these famous examples of what usually refer to as bubbles. I think the term was first used in connection with the South Sea Company in France in the early 18th century. And of course, the tulip mania in the Netherlands is always cited before that, where where presumably what's happened is prices are going up. People, as you say, extrapolate. Therefore, they buy. And this, of course, adds to the, if people tend to buy because they see prices going up, that adds to the demand and drives prices still further up and so forth. So we seem to get a big mismatch between rational expectations and bubbles. And I'd like perhaps you want to go into more detail some of your experiments.
Well, no, and things like the South Sea bubble, whether or not they were they existed or not, it's controversial. Do you realize there was a rumored merger before that that didn't? So it could have been that things like the South Sea bubble were really rational information aggregation in a market. So historically, I think that there's some controversies, although we see cases where they in actual stock markets where they seem to be bubbles. No doubt we can create them in a laboratory. The saving grace of a bubble, though, and the herd, the Keynesian herdian idea, is basically, I think, what you started this conversation out with. People differ. People will notice that there's probably a bubble here. They'll begin to speculate on the bubble crashing. That kind of speculation, that diversity of opinion, that understanding of the situation that we're all in, actually causes people to anticipate where it's going, and I think ultimately causes the undoing of the bubble and preventing it from just going on and on and on, like a Ponzi scheme. Now, a Ponzi scheme, of course, is a particularly interesting one since they do crash, but they can go quite a ways beforehand. And I think that instruments, special instruments, which help organize this diversity of opinion, help people understand when this diversity of opinion is taking place, all of those things, I think, will help markets be more efficient and channel the information without these misguiding, some kind of misguiding prices, and cause the system to be much more efficient. I think that that's, as our understanding proceeds, we can see it getting ready to happen.
Well, Charlie, it's been a great discussion.
Oh, it's always exciting chatting with you, Ken. Just absolutely amazing to chat with somebody who's been such a pioneer in shaping my theory, the theories I test, and seeing the things that you've worked on so long, actually one be able to see it happening in a in an experiment. It's very exciting.
You're too kind. Thank you.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.